This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Gary Clinton here, and I've done it again. I've gone out and I've taken the South African serial of the Avengers, taken its 6 15-minute segments, and re-edited them down so that they kind of flow together, taking out really just the beginning of every program and the end of every program and the recapitulation of the last day's program, so hopefully they move quite smartly one into the other. Now, I also figure you're probably going to want to know where the original series segment ended and the other one began. I've done that by leaving this.
The Avengers.
The Avengers South Africa starred Donald Monette and Diana Appleby. They were broadcast weeknightly in 1971 and 1972 on Springbok Radio. This was the South African Broadcasting Company's English-speaking wing. These stories were adapted from scripts for the TV series, slightly rejiggered for the episodic cliffhanger format. Each episode was just under 15 minutes long and included short advertisements for the sponsors, Coldwater Umo. One of the things, if you're familiar with the Avengers, that you will notice is that Mrs. Peel is acting a little peculiarly in this story from, I think, 1972. She's just not really quite herself. Now, I was aware, and you may be aware if you're familiar with the radio series, that they were not particularly concerned with being exactly true to the original series. That is to say, some of the episodes, actually quite a few of the episodes in The Avengers South Africa, were rewritten from stories that Mrs. Peel did not appear in. Diana Rigg, who played the delectable Mrs. Peel, left the show at the end of 1967 and was replaced by Linda Thoreson for the 1968 series as Tara King. Now, just between you and me, I didn't watch many Tara King episodes. I was just too hurt by the absence of Mrs. Peel. If you were 21 years old in 1967 and male and watched The Avengers, then you know exactly what I'm talking about and why. I still miss Mrs. Peel. This episode was a Tara King episode. Still, it works pretty well, even if Mrs. Peel isn't really quite Mrs. Peel.
Now, from the makers of Coldwater Omo.
A black Rolls Royce stood outside an imposing-looking building near Whitehall in London. Inside the building was a long corridor with rows of offices on either side. Each door had the title of the area of England printed upon it. Southwest Division, Southeast Division, Midlands, etc. At the end of the corridor was an office marked Coordination and Control. Two tough-looking guards stood on either side of the door. They gazed impassively ahead. Further down the corridor, there was a young woman in charlady's clothes. She was on her hands and knees, scrubbing away at the floor. She looked up and murmured,
"It won't be long now."
The Avengers. John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers. Episode 1 of this story, in which Mother, as usual, hands a case over to John Steed, who thinks it very serious, and Emma Peel thinks it's a case of... Love All. The office of the Missile Redeployment Ministry was luxuriously furnished. Thick curtains covered the windows. Around an oval table, several distinguished-looking men were seated. On his feet at the head of the table, Sir Rodney Kellogg, a dapper, white-haired man, was addressing the meeting. He had about him an air of quiet respectability, and he was obviously in a position of higher authority than the others. In front of him lay a book bearing the notice, "Read, digest, and pass on."
"And finally, may I impress upon you that this is a matter of utmost secrecy. The Royal Commission's report must on no account be discussed outside these walls. Each of you will read it in turn and pass it on to the man whose name is next on the list. When you're all thoroughly acquainted with its contents, we will meet again to put its recommendations into effect. That's all, gentlemen. Good evening to you all."
The men left, and Sir Rodney moved over to the guards at the door.
Thank you. You needn't wait any longer.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The guards walked smartly down the corridor and through the double doors. Immediately, the charlady picked up her bucket and walked down the corridor. She walked boldly through the door and closed it behind her. The moment Sir Rodney heard the sound of the bucket, he swung round, his face suffused with delight and anticipation.
"Martha, darling."
"Rodance. Oh, my sweetheart."
"Oh, I'm so sorry the meeting took so long."
"Oh, it doesn't matter, darling, so long as you're here. Oh, you are lovely. What did you talk about at the meeting?"
Routine stuff, mostly. All very dull, I'm afraid."
"Tell me about it, please."
No, not now. We've more important things."
"No, I want to hear about the meeting."
"My little secrets are so boring to you, my love. It wouldn't possibly interest a lovely girl like you."
"Oh, but you're quite wrong, Rodders, darling. I'm interested in everything you do. Everything about you. Especially your secrets." "Oh, you are going to tell me everything, aren't you, darling?"
John Steed thought the morning rather cold, but quite bracing. He walked rather jauntily down the street, swinging his umbrella and raising his bowler to the odd acquaintance. At a sign reading, "Danger, Men at Work," Steed raised an eyebrow, turned off into the cordoned area, and reached Mother's headquarters.
"Hello, Mother. That sign outside's a bit misleading, isn't it?"
Mother, in his wheelchair, was playing table tennis with Mrs. Peel.
"I have to get some form of exercise. My game, I think, Mrs. Peel."
What's the problem?"
"That's what I'm waiting to hear."
"You know what a sticky wicket is, don't you?"
"A difficult one."
"That's what we're batting on at the moment."
"Why?"
"There's a security leak at the ministry."
"Which department?"
"Missile redeployment."
"Well, that's impossible. All the personnel have a top QR security rating."
I know. "But the evidence is overwhelming. A glass of white wine, Steve, Mrs. Peel."
"Oh, no, thanks, Mother."
"A bit early for me."
"Never too early for white wine. Red, yes. White, never. As I say, there is a leak, all right. The other side seems to know each move we make almost before we make it."
"Any suspects?"
"Yes."
"Who?"
"Every man in the department. Had them all under surveillance for 2 months." That's better. Hard work playing Mrs. Peel."
"Have you checked all their contacts?"
"With a microscope. All perfectly legitimate. No leads there."
"Who in charge over there?
Sir Rodney Kellogg.
You want me to go over there?
No, let Steve go. We'll have another game. And do try to give me a little competition this time, Mrs. Peel.
Sir Rodney Kellogg was sitting at his desk. Martha, the child lady, was sitting on his lap.
So, that's the situation, my angel. The report proposed a streamlining of the divisional areas and an overhaul of the entire national security system.
Oh, I see.
Why you should bother your pretty little head with such tedious stuff is beyond me.
Oh, but Rodney, darling, I find it fascinating. There's one thing, though, that's not quite clear.
What's that, my love?
What happens to the Pearl Beach base after the reorganization?
Oh, it'll be used as a decoy. The new center of the East Anglian complex will be...
That's enough, Sir Rodney.
The curtains parted and Metcalf, a tough-looking young man, entered suddenly.
Who the devil are you?
Metcalf, security. I thought something like this was going on. I must ask you both to accompany me to headquarters.
Oh, Rodney, darling, it's all my fault. I'm so sorry.
No, my dearest. It was I who was foolish. You mustn't blame yourself.
Oh, but I do. I got you into this mess, and it's my responsibility to get you out. Oh, Rodgers, hold me just once more.
Martha placed herself close to Sir Rodney, looking up beseechingly into his eyes, and slipped a pearl-handled revolver from under her overalls. She pointed it at Metcalf.
Has to be done, my darling. It has to be done.
When John Steed arrived at the ministry and walked up the steps towards Sir Rodney's office, he heard 3 shots from down the corridor. He broke into a run and burst into Sir Rodney's office at speed. Sir Rodney was standing, gun in hand, staring down at Metcalf's dead body.
Give me that gun, Sir Rodney. Seems we've been shooting triplicate. What's it all about?
I found him in here, going through my papers. There was a struggle.
And you shot him?
Yes.
Without giving him a chance to explain?
Well, I've been drinking. I wasn't thinking very clearly.
I take it you have a permit for this gun?
Oh, yes, of course.
Where did you get it?
It belonged to my father.
A small pistol with a pearl handle?
Well, maybe my mother. I can't remember.
Steed looked at Sir Rodney and without a word broke open the gun, removing the remaining bullets.
Here, load it.
Hmm?
I said load it. Go on.
Yes, must be jammed. Why are you looking at me like that? Are you implying that I don't know how to load my own gun?
I'm implying that you're covering up for someone. Somebody who gave you this gun and told you to confess to a murder you didn't commit.
Oh, that's absurd. Why should I want to ruin a successful career?
Sir Rodney stopped in mid-sentence. His eyes settled on the charwoman's bucket standing in the corner. A silly smile touched his lips, and his expression became, hideous word, but nonetheless the correct one, gooey.
Something the matter, Sir Rodney?
I'm not myself today. What was I saying?
Never mind. I'm putting you under house arrest pending a full investigation. You'll be confined to this office till further notice. Oh, one last question, Sir Rodney. Are you aware that there's a security leak from this department?
And what did he reply to that question, Steed?
Nothing. He looked at me as though I was talking Mongolian.
And were you?
No, but I do quite well, actually.
Shot, Mrs. Peel.
So you don't think he knew who Metcalf was?
I don't think he knew who anyone was. He was too busy thinking of something else.
Any idea what?
No. He seemed to spend the entire interview in a kind of trance. He kept staring into space with an idiotic smile on his face.
Could be drink, of course. Some people do overindulge.
Could be drugs.
Could be love.
Sounds as though he's being got at.
Intimidation?
Blackmail?
Infatuation?
I must ask you to curb your natural frivolity, Mrs. Beale. This case could have serious consequences. The idea of a respectable man like Sir Rodney losing his head over a woman is too ludicrous for words.
But love is ludicrous, Mother. When a man's in love with a woman, she can make him do anything. Don't you agree, Steve?
May I take that up with you later, Mrs. Beale? Meanwhile, anyone for table tennis?
The Avengers.
There is a public call box in the street outside the Ministry of Missile Redeployment. Into the call box, a charlady, dressed in the traditional clothes, made her way slowly and without fuss. She picked up the phone and dialed the number without reference to the telephone books. In another part of London, a phone rang. A man's hand, well kept, clean, with beautifully manicured nails, stretched out. On the third finger of the hand was a very distinctive ring, a design of entwined hearts. The man picked up the phone.
Bromfield.
Arthur here, darling. Things are getting a bit hot, I'm afraid.
What do you mean?
They're on to Sir Rodney. The security man's dead. He's confessed.
Then break contact. Throw him to the wolves.
That's exactly what I've done.
Good. Better call and see me sometime. Have to work out another plan. Meanwhile, you better shed that charlady image, haven't you?
That night, Sir Rodney paced the floor of his office. He called to the guard at the door.
I wonder if it would be possible for me to see the personnel file. It's in Mr. Tate's office.
Well, Sir Rodney, I don't know. I mean...
Oh, now, look here, man. I know you're only doing a job guarding me like this, but I can't be expected to relax. I might as well do a little work, too. Now, come along.
Well, I suppose it's all right. Don't see why not. I'll get it for you.
The guard went away, and Sir Rodney continued his pacing. Leaving the door open, the guard returned.
There you are, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The guard closed the door and said to the other guard on duty...
You know, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark.
That's Shakespeare, isn't it?
Yeah, King Lear. Just before he fights Macduff and goes mad. Can't be any more mad than Sir Rodney. Bonkers, if you ask me.
Had the two guards seen Sir Rodney at that point, they would have been sure of the fact. For Sir Rodney, having searched the personnel file, had found what he was looking for.
Domestic. Here we are. Martha Roberts, 4 Chester Place. Got it. Oh, my beloved. Now I've found your address. Wild horses can't keep you from me now.
So saying, Sir Rodney flung the file down on the desk and, running the length of the room, jumped through the plate glass window. The two guards burst into the room.
Blimey! He went through the window!
A 20-foot drop. He's got away. Look, there he goes.
Mother's headquarters, white wine was still the order of the day, or night.
Splendid. Beautifully chilled. So, you don't think Sir Rodney killed Metfar, Steed?
I'm certain that he didn't. Look at this.
Steed produced the pearl-handled revolver.
He told me he had a firearms permit.
And you've checked?
Nothing registered in his name.
Then who is he carrying up for?
Whoever gave him the gun, presumably.
Small, pearl-handled... suggests...
A woman?
Yes, but not necessarily. Plenty of men used to carry these in the early 19th century. Not that I hope we have to go back quite that far. Mother? Yes? What? Well, you're a couple of blithering fatheads.
Don't tell me. Sir Rodney's escaped?
Right. Jumped through a window 20 feet from the ground. Now, what would make an aged civil servant do that? Madness?
Desperation?
Or love?
Mrs. Peel, I have never known you so incurably romantic, or so unhelpful.
I'm sorry, I can't help it.
And I can't help being thirsty. Open another bottle of wine.
Sir Rodney made a clean getaway in his rolls. He drove straight to number 4 Chester Place, parked outside, ran nimbly up the steps, and rang the doorbell. Some little while later, the door opened. Martha stood in the doorway, but not as the grubby charlady. She looked young and beautiful. She showed no sign of recognizing Sir Rodney. In a cultivated voice, she said...
Yes?
I was looking for Martha Roberts.
Oh, you mean my aunt? She's in the bath. Can I give her a message?
Well, not really. It's personal.
What name shall I say?
Well, just tell her it's, Rodders.
Rodders?
Yes, that's right, Rodders.
She'll know who that is, will she?
Oh, yes, 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 indeed she will.
Right. I'm afraid I can't ask you in because we're in such a mess. Auntie never receives visitors until she's had a chance to tidy up. Just wait, will you?
Oh, of course, of course. Forever, if necessary.
They say there's no fool like an old fool. Here's proof, all right. Inside the house, Martha made another telephone call.
Hartfield.
Darling, it's Martha here. Sir Rodney's got away from the ministry. He's waiting outside. What do I do?
You must go to him. Can't have him blabbing everything. Keep him waiting for 10 minutes, then I'll be over and waiting in the street.
What do I do?
Dress yourself in your child latest outfit. Meet him. Get him to drive you to some secluded spot, near the park, perhaps.
Yes, and...
Dispose of him. Don't worry, Martha. I shall not be far away.
It has to be done.
It has to be done, but quickly. 10 minutes. Understand?
Steed and Emma Peel were doing a routine check on Sir Rodney's office. The guard was slightly more than crestfallen.
Well, how are we to believe that anyone of Sir Rodney's age would undertake such an escape? I mean, would you like that jump, Mr. Steed?
Not through a closed window.
The point is, why not open it and shin down a drainpipe sooner than take the chance of injuring oneself?
That doesn't make sense.
People in love never do, as I've been trying to tell Mother.
You say he asked for this file?
Oh, that's right. A personnel file. Don't ask me why.
If you knew, it might help.
Well, I didn't see any harm in it, so I went and fetched it.
You haven't touched anything in here?
Oh, no, Mr. Steed, not a thing. We've left everything as we found it.
Personnel file closed on the table.
As though flung down hurriedly. He found something he was looking for.
But what? Or whom?
Yeah. If only we knew what sort of personnel he was looking for. All right, guard, I'll put in a good word for you. Night.
Sir Rodney waited in Chester Street for 10 minutes. During that time, a sports car drew up across the road. The hand that steered the wheel had a distinctive ring on one finger. Bromfield had arrived. He watched as the door to number 4 opened. Martha, as a charlady, came out. In her cockney voice, she said...
Oh, Rodgers, have they let you go? Oh,
Martha, my darling, I escaped.
Escaped? Oh, you shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, I know, but I just had to see you again.
You must go back immediately.
Well, out of the question. Every minute away from you is torture.
They'll be looking for you. You don't want to bring me into this, do you?
Ah, they'll never find us, my love. We'll disappear together, somewhere far away where we can be safe.
Martha, looking over her shoulder, saw the sports car and said...
All right, Rodney, I'll go with you. Take me wherever you like.
Oh, my darling. Oh, made me so happy. You'll never regret this, I promise you.
No, but you might.
Never. Never, I swear it. Come on.
Sir Rodney took Martha by the hand and led her to the rolls. Seconds later, they were purring their way towards the park, followed by the sports car. At a convenient spot, Martha said...
Pull up at the end of this street, please, Rodgers.
Yes, but we haven't much time.
Please do as I say, darling. I want to ask you something.
Oh, very well, dearest. Anything you say.
Kiss me, Rodney.
Of course, my love. But don't you think...
No buts. I want you to make love to me. I want to be sure you do.
Oh, you know I do, my darling.
And you'll never leave me?
Never, never.
Martha opened her handbag and withdrew another pearl-handled revolver.
Promise?
I promise.
Oh, what a pity.
Sir Rodney Kellogg slid away from her, an expression of utter amazement on his face as he collapsed across the steering wheel, dead. Minutes later, Martha joined Bromfield in the sports car.
I'm sorry, darling. There was no other way.
Never mind. There are plenty more fish in the sea, all ready for catching and frying.
The Avengers.
John Steed's telephone man.
Steed?
Mother, there's a Rolls Royce parked at the Ivy of Mules. There's a dead man in it.
Sir Rodney?
I'll bet my pre-lunch and dry martini on it. See to it, will you, Steed?
Steed did see to it. He and Mrs. Peel were in the mules in record time.
Nasty.
Poor old Sir Rodney. This is one murder he can't accept responsibility for.
No sign of the weapon.
Not this time. Small bullet hole. Could be another pearl-handled revolver.
Could be. What do you suppose he was doing round here?
Eloping?
Oh, now, Mrs. Peel, don't startle that again.
Take my word for it, Steed. In a case like this, you've just... Cherchez la femme.
What's that?
Perfume. Very, very exclusive. Ah, a clue at last.
Mrs. Peel picked up a wisp of handkerchief from the floor.
A lady's handkerchief, and beautifully perfumed.
Well, that's your territory, Mrs. Peel. Think you can identify it?
Of course. It's reckless abandon.
Sounds highly appropriate. Who makes it?
A company called Bellchamber Brothers.
Well, that's your next call then, isn't it, Mrs. Peel?
Chamber Bros, perfumiers extraordinary, was so exclusive Mrs. Peel had to positively hunt out their premises. The shop was old-fashioned, but tastefully decorated. Mrs. Peel entered and made her way between the bowls of roses and lavender water, not noticing the tall blonde who was inspecting some scent in a display cabinet. An immaculately groomed, languid young man glided forward.
Come, Edmund, what can I do for you?
I'd like to speak to Mr. Bellchamber.
That's my brother. He's away in Provence at the moment, crushing Lily.
Really? I'm surprised she doesn't object.
I was about to say crushing lilies for Lily of the Valley, madam. James always pops over at this time of year.
But if he's your brother, why isn't your name Bellchamber?
Oh, but it is, madam.
Oh, well then, how did you know I didn't want to speak to you?
Nobody ever does, madam. I've got no personality, you see.
None at all?
Not one iota. My brother says that as a salesman, I'm a total disaster. When he's here, he shuts me up in the back of the shop like Cinderella.
Really? Well, you know how she ended up, don't you?
How?
She lived happily ever after.
After what? Yes, I see what you mean. Thank you very much for the encouragement. And how can I be of service?
Well, you can tell me something.
Certainly.
It's reckless abandon. Is it a popular line?
With the discerning and the wealthy, it's priced a little high for most pockets.
So the number of clients who use it would be,
10, 15, 20 at the most.
Mm-hmm. Could you give me a list of their names?
Oh, well, that's a little irregular, madam.
Ah, but you see, I'm writing an article on perfumes of the aristocracy. I take it you wouldn't be adverse to a little publicity.
Oh, as long as it's discreet, madam. Very well. Please take a seat.
Bellchamber disappeared. Mrs. Peel settled down to wait, watched by the tall blonde, who was Martha, the charlady.
Here we are, madam. As far as I can tell from our records, this is a complete list.
I'm very grateful.
Perhaps you'd care to put your gratitude into more tangible form, madam? These shelves hold our latest range.
What? Oh, yes, certainly. Here's my card. Send me a case of Lily of the Valley, distilled by your brother, of course.
Yes, madam, of course. Thank you very much.
Mrs. Peel left the shop. Martha moved forward, swiftly picked up Mrs. Peel's card and hurried out.
Just a minute, madam. You've forgotten your bottle of... reckless abandon.
Down in the street, Martha rushed through the traffic to a parked sports car, opening the door and flinging herself into it alongside the driver.
Get after that girl, the one over there.
Why? Why, for heaven's sake, Martha?
The list with my name on it.
Has she now?
Yes, but I've got her address.
And don't worry, my darling. I'll phone Freeman. He'll handle it for us. Don't worry. He never fails.
Well, whatever the case is, it is now the case that we have a case of the breaks.
Tracing one scent, John Steed was following up on clues at the Ministry of Missile Redeployment, interviewing Sir Rodney's second-in-command, Horatio Tate.
A woman? You say that Sir Rodney was killed by a woman?
It looks like it, Mr. Tate. Did you ever see him with one?
Never. He avoided them like the plague. I can't say I blame him, really. Extraordinary creatures, women. You never understand what makes them tick.
And Sir Rodney felt the same way?
They were anathema, Steed. Sheer anathema. Mention women's lib and he'd go purple in the face.
Perhaps he was having an unhappy love affair.
Oh, impossible. There's no room for that kind of thing in our line of country. We lead a very monastic life here, you understand. We can't allow ourselves to be distracted by
Excuse me, Mr. Tate, the Commission's report. If you'd just put a tick against your name when you've read it and pass it on to the next on the list.
Oh, yes. Put it on the desk, please.
All right, thank you.
You were saying?
I was saying that what you're suggesting is out of the question, Steed. If Sir Rodney had been carrying on, as they say, I would certainly have known about it.
I see. Well, then I'm sorry to have wasted your time.
Not at all. Glad to scotch the rumor before it spreads.
De mortuis nil nisi bonum.
Bye. Yes, quite. Exactly.
Steed left. Tate frowned.
De mortuis nil nisi. Oh, well.
In a nearby office, Roxbury, a fellow worker, picked up his phone.
Roxbury.
Tate here. Look, I've just had a fellow in my office suggesting that Sir Rodney was playing about with some woman here in the office. And she killed him.
What? Well, goodness gracious, whatever next? The chaps in the club will have a good laugh about that. In his office, you say? Well, miracles never cease. But pigs will fly before we see any of that sort of thing in this department.
Roxby was still chuckling as he replaced the telephone and turned to gaze affectionately at the woman next to him. It was Martha, back in her charlady gear.
Darling.
I've got to go now, Tucker.
Oh, so soon, the puppet.
Well, I can't hang around here all day. I've got work to do.
When shall I see you again?
When you got something to tell me?
Oh, my heart is filled with things to tell you, my treasure.
Not those sort of things. I mean important things. The things I asked you to find out for me. And you promised.
Oh, I know, and I know. I keep my promise. Oh, but how will I find you, darling?
You won't have to, Basil. I'll find you. Bye now.
With that, Martha picked up her skirts and her bucket and left. Mrs. Peel, in her apartment, having studied the list she'd obtained from Bell Chamber Bloss, was consulting Mother on the telephone.
I want to eliminate some of the names on the list first, Mother. Tell me about Lady Vanessa Cholmondeley Davenport.
There's nothing to tell about her except she's dead. Had a drink last Tuesday.
Oh. Mrs. Maud Kingsley Ravenshoe?
Forget her. Never since she came out in 38.
The Honourable Malvina Harcourt-Smith?
Cross her out. She's a platoon commander and a girl guide. Remember that ghastly scandal when she pitched up at Cannes with three brownies?
Oh. Well, the Duchess of... Oh, hold on, Mother. There's someone at the front door.
Mrs. Peel, still holding the list, put down the phone and went to the front door. A man stood in the doorway, a snub-nosed gun pointing straight at her.
The list. That's what I've come for. Yeah. That perfume list.
Smells of danger to me, Mrs. Peel.
Mm-hmm.
The Avengers.
When Sir Rodney Kellogg was murdered, the only positive clue near the body was a flimsy lace handkerchief. Mrs. Peel was inclined to gloat, as she'd always maintained that Sir Robert had been seduced into giving away top secrets by a woman. Mrs. Peel had followed up on the clue of the handkerchief by tracing the perfume on it. Bell Chambers had given her a short list of all the clients in London who used the exclusive perfume Reckless Abandon. Mrs. Peel, not quite moving in the exalted society channels, had been on the phone to Mother when she was interrupted by the arrival of the man who now held her at gunpoint. The man's orders were clear enough. Mrs. Peel was in a tight spot and she knew it.
Back. Back. That's it. Now, without any more trouble, pick up that cigarette lighter on the table.
You?
Do as I say. Now, flick it open. Light it. That's it. Now you will watch this list burn. Don't move.
The man placed the paper into the flame. It burned rapidly. Mrs. Peel suddenly jerked the lighter forward.
Yeah.
The flame singed the man's hand. He yelped, dropped the list. Mrs. Peel chopped the gun from his hand. They grappled with each other, Mrs. Peel trying to stamp out the burning paper with her feet as they did so. Mother, on the phone, was completely confused.
You. What's going on? Look at what you're doing. Get it over with.
Mrs. Peel was trying her best. She struggled free and made for the burning paper. The man went to the gun on the floor.
Got it.
Mrs. Peel was forced to leave the charred paper and defend herself yet again. Mrs. Peel closed in, grasping the man's wrist that held the gun. The struggle was fierce. The man's greater strength was telling. He was forcing the gun round towards her, nearer, nearer. With the last of her strength, Mrs. Peel dodged to one side, twisting the man's arm suddenly. The man gasped and slowly collapsed to the floor. Mrs. Peel rushed to the list to find it burned away into ashes. She turned back to the man and searched him, finding nothing but a curious ring upon his finger.
Curious? A sort of entwined heart motif. And an inscription. Casanova Inc.
She moved to the phone.
Mrs. Peel, are you there? Are you still living?
Hello? Hello, Mother? Yes, just about. Sorry to keep you waiting. What do we know about Casanova Inc.? Any ideas?
While Mother and Emma Peel were talking on the phone, the char lady, Martha, was also putting through a call.
I'm phoning from the ministry.
I think that's wise.
It's all right. The public phone in the corridor doesn't go through the switchboard. Everything's going splendidly. They're all studying the book. Every one of them is falling under the spell. Tate's got it at the moment. He must be nearly finished. He's had it long enough. Then I shall be moving in.
Right. But just watch it. We don't want any more trouble.
Just a minute. Now I've got to go, darling. This looks like trouble.
Martha slammed down the phone and watched with growing concern as down the corridor tramped a large policewoman. She looked at all the names on the doors, paused outside Tate's, knocked, and walked in. Tate, without looking up from the book, said,
"Come in."
The policewoman walked over to the desk. Tate looked up. His eyes gleamed. His fleshy mouth fell open in astonishment and delight. He appeared to hang on her every word as she said,
"Are you the owner of a car number UGF711F?
"Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes, I am."
"You're parked in a no-parking zone."
"I am?"
"Yeah. Have you anything to say?"
"Oh, yes. Yes, I love you. I love you. I love you."
"Darling. Darling, are you there?"
"Martha, what is it now?"
"Darling, it's all gone wrong. I can't explain on the phone, but the first person Tate saw after the treatment from the book wasn't me. It was a policewoman."
"Great heavens.
It's a real spoke in our wheel. I must see you."
"All right, tonight."
"No, not now. I'm coming straight over."
"But, Martha..."
"No buts about it. I must see you now."
Steed arrived at Tate's office, he found Tate at his desk. Next to him, handcuffed to him, was the policewoman.
Was it really necessary to handcuff him?
I didn't do it. He handcuffed me. He said, those on the law are joined together. Let no man put asunder.
Ah, my dearest. You know, Steed, they lead a dog's life, these adorable girls in blue.
Really? Is that so?
We shouldn't allow it. We should complain to the government.
We are the government.
Yes. So am I. Well, I shall complain to the Prime Minister.
Well, I'm sure he'll be devastated.
How would you like it if you had to face dangerous criminals unarmed?
Oh, not my cup of tea at all. Tell me, Mr. Tate, have you always felt so strongly about law enforcement?
No.
Then why this sudden crusade?
Someone came into my life.
This lady?
That's right. Oh, my love. Number 729154, Policewoman Grimshaw.
Oh, just my luck. My first traffic offence and I end up tied to Casanova. I should have stayed in the Wrens.
In Mother's headquarters, he was dividing his attentions pretty equally between a gin and tonic and the ring Mrs. Peel had placed on the arm of his wheelchair.
Very civilized midday.
The ring?
The gin. Casanova Inc. I do confess, although I consider myself an extraordinarily well-read and knowledgeable man, I've never heard of him. Don't know him.
Well, the man who wore this obviously knew about me.
I've always thought you attracted the most strange assailants.
Beggars can't be choosers, Mother. I have to take what I can get.
So, they'll be very keen to destroy that list. Do you recall any of the names upon it?
Mm-mm. Only the ones I read out to you.
Pity. Obviously, you hadn't reached the one that mattered. Ah, Steed. Good. Just in time to pour me the other half.
Pleasure, Mother.
Tell me, was that incredible report about Tate accurate?
I'm afraid so. He seems to have gone completely off the rails. Suddenly developed a passion for an Amazon in a blue uniform.
Extraordinary. No, don't drown it, Steve. Oh, thank you. Tell me, where is Tate now?
In custody.
He should be in an asylum. Yes, the whole case is taking on a strange pattern. Don't like the picture.
Neither do I. Any leads yet?
Only this ring Mrs. Peel acquired. Not romantically, I hasten to add.
Let me see. Casanova Inc. What's this got to do with it?
It's about time you found out, Steve.
What about little old me?
You go back to the ministry, Mrs. Peel, and see if you can isolate the germ that's causing this epidemic. See if you can track down, for want of a better phrase, the love bug.
Mrs. Peel returned to the ministry and explored Tate's office. It was there that she came across the book marked Commission Report, Read, Digest, and Pass On. She opened it, glanced at it without interest, and then suddenly became alert. She sank down into the leather chair and began to concentrate. Steed had also done a little reading in a telephone book he'd found, Casanova Inc. It was in an office block in the East End. Steed found it with difficulty. The reception room was filled with books. Every wall. Steed walked round reading the titles.
The Complete Works of Rosemary Z. Blade.
With that, Steed knocked on the door, which carried the sign Casanova Inc. Rosemary Z. Blade, Director, and opened it. A woman's voice was reading.
Aha, my dear, he cried. So your husband is the notorious highwayman, Blackjack McGinty. He shall remember this night as long as he lives, which won't be long. With that, he began to advance upon her. His eyes narrowed evilly, and his breast heaved with lascivious passion.
Steed entered the room.
She shrank back against the wall, her eyes filled with tears. Defile me if you must, you villain, she whispered, but my soul will never be yours. What do I care for your soul, replied the fiend. I have other fish to fry. With which base rejoinder, he put out a hand and
mopped his fevered brow, Rosemary?
Shh! I'm not Rosemary. He is.
Steed followed her gesture. Behind the desk, leaning back with closed eyes, was a tall, elegant man. His hands were crossed. On one of his fingers was a diamond ring. The motif was entwined hearts.
The Avengers.
Steed quickly controlled his surprise when the tall, elegant man rose from behind the desk and said,
I am Rosemary Zetley. And who are you?
An admirer. You've been a heroine of mine for years.
Yes, well, you've interrupted my flow.
Rosemary? The flow? And your name is?
Thelma. Oh, how could you be so thoughtless?
Couldn't you try to help?
The master doesn't need help. He needs complete relaxation in order to feel the vibrations.
Vibrations?
From the astral plane. You don't suppose I could write the way I do if my mind wasn't in tune with the other world, do you?
I don't indeed.
And yet you come barging in here without so much as a by or leave, just when complete rapport had been established. It's too bad. Oh, dear.
It's all right, Thelma. Don't upset yourself. Philistines will never understand. What can I do for you?
I'd like you to autograph my book.
I only give autographs between 3 and 3.15 in the afternoons.
Oh, what a shame. And I bought every one of your books.
All 349?
Of course. I have them bound in purple Morocco. I had to get rid of my Bronte first editions to make room for them.
Ah. Well, then you're entitled to one of our rings, my dear sir.
Rosemary opened a drawer in his desk and took out a box. He handed Steed a ring, one with the entwined heart motif.
Oh, thank you. How extremely thoughtful of you. Now I feel one of the family.
Well, since you're obviously a man of taste and refinement, I'll sign your book.
Steed whipped out a small pocketbook.
How gracious of you. If you just put, to John, with love from Rosemary.
Oh, certainly. There.
Oh, thank you. You know, I met someone with one of these rings only the other day.
Oh, who?
I can't recall the name. A very large man. Had a black beard.
Oh, yes, it sounds like Freeman. He's one of our employees. All our employees wear the rings.
Is he here now?
Possibly. Ask Mr. Bromfield. He's in charge of our printing department. Through that door there.
Thank you.
As Steed moved after the door indicated, Rosemary settled down and, closing his eyes, said...
No, where was I?
With which base rejoinder he put out his hand.
Ah, yes, yes. He put out his hand and grasped the yielding flesh of her arm in a vice-like grip. Unhand me, you base villain, she cried, her heart in turmoil, or it will be the worse for you. De Quincey laughed. A harsh, rasping sound that chilled her to the marrow of her bones.
Steed reached the printing room door, opened it, sighed, and closed it to find himself in the printing room. The man Bromfield approached.
Mr. Bromfield?
Yes, that's right. What can I do for you?
I was looking for Freeman.
They're not here at the moment. Is he a friend of yours?
Yes, I told him how much I enjoyed the books, and he promised to show me around.
I see. You're a fan, are you?
A fan? But of course. I never go to sleep without a Rosemary Z. Glade under my pillow. Love in the Bernese Oberland. That was my favorite.
You've seen Rosemary?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I think I cut off his flow.
I shouldn't worry. That particular fountain will never run dry. Athene?
Yes, Mr. Bromfield.
Bring Mr.
Steed.
Bring Mr. Steed an advance copy of Love in Budley Salterton, will you? Perhaps you'd like to take it with you. It's hot off the press.
Oh, too kind.
The creature called Athene picked up a parcel and handed it to Bromfield.
Not that one. You know perfectly well that those are forbidden. Already ordered. One from the other pile.
There we are, Mr. Steed. With the compliments of Casanova Inc.
Thank you.
I hope it sends you to sleep as effectively as the others. Good day.
Oh, there is just one other little request. I've never seen a printing press in action. Do you think I might leave by the other exit and walk through the plant?
Certainly. Help yourself.
Steed did, by swiftly exchanging the book given to him with one from the top of the forbidden pile. No one saw the action.
Amazing. But these small presses can produce so much magic.
Bromfield gave Steed a keen look and said,
"Goodbye, Mr. Steed. I hope you enjoy the book."
Steed shook hands, noting the now familiar ring, and left. Bromfield was standing staring after him thoughtfully when Martha, not in charlady guise, appeared from behind a pile of books and said,
"I've seen that man at the ministry."
"What?"
"He came to question Sir Rodney. I saw him again in Tate's office."
"Then he's too close for comfort. We'll have to deal with him."
"How?"
"Easy. The other fellow at the ministry, Friar, he's in love with your charlady act, isn't he?"
"Mm-hmm."
"And all you have to do is ask him to do you a favor."
And so, not all that while later...
"A favor? A favor for you, of course. My darling, you have only to name it."
"Thank you, George. Oh, I knew I could count on you."
"Command me, then."
"I want you to get rid of somebody for me. Someone who's becoming a nuisance."
"A rival? His name. Quickly, his name."
"John Steed."
"Steed. I'll kill him."
"You took the words right out of my mouth, George."
John Steed, back in his apartment, opened the books he'd obtained from Casanova, Inc. The novel he discarded. The other book he opened and stared at in amazement.
All the pages are blank. Well, what's this? Set in the middle of the cover, a small indentation. A minute, sparkling eye. Fascinating.
Steed closed the book and went to open the door.
"Oh, hello, Mr. Fryer. Is something the matter? Oh, come in. Oh, forgive me for mentioning it, but that gun you're holding, the safety catch is off. But something tells me you knew that."
"I did. Put your hands above your head."
"Why? Why are you pointing that thing at me?"
"Because you're a philanderer."
"I beg your pardon?"
"You've trifled with a woman I love."
"I haven't trifled all day."
"She told me so herself. And now you're going to pay for it."
"Well, at least tell me her name."
"Uh-huh. So she's one of many, is she?" "Just as I thought. One of nature's parasites. The world will be a cleaner place without you, my friend."
"Look, can't we talk this over sensibly?"
"That's what they all say." "No."
"Well, in which case, there's nothing for me to do but..."
Steve stepped forward, grabbed the wrist that held the gun. With one swift movement, he forced the weapon out of Fryer's hand. Got a good grip and threw Fryer across the room.
"And all for the love of a lady."
In the missile redeployment department, Mrs. Peel had been examining the office that had been occupied by Tate. She'd found the book marked Commission Report, Read, Digest, and Pass On. She'd been reading away with intense interest for hours. In the passage outside, Martha, in charlady outfit, whispered to Bromfield,
"She's in there. She's been reading the book. She's the girl I saw at Bell Chambers' perfume shop. She's on to us."
"Then she's solving the problem for us. Is the door locked?"
"Yes. I locked it from the outside."
"Leave this to me. I shall be the first person she sees."
"Well, who locked me in there? How dare you?" "What? Oh.
Hello, my dear. I've come to take you away. Will you come with me?"
"Oh, yes. Yes. I'd follow you anywhere."
That kind of love isn't just blind, it's plain daft.
The Avengers.
Steed hadn't had a great deal of difficulty. He'd merely disarmed him and knocked him out by throwing him across the room. It was at that point that the telephone rang.
John Steed?
Mother here. Say, Steed, why don't you report?
Oh, hello, Mother. Sorry, a bit of difficulty. Just had a man from the ministry drop in on me.
Oh? Hot news?
No, he's out cold at the moment. It's all extremely odd. Mrs. Peel seems to be right. Something's happened to people's glands. This fellow Friar burst in here a short while ago and accused me of pinching his lady friend.
Literally?
Figuratively, but I suppose it's much the same thing. Anyway, I think we're on to the root cause of the trouble. I'll report in the morning.
Good. Come to breakfast. Eggs, bacon, champagne, nothing like it.
It's a date.
Oh, and bring Mrs. Peel, if you can find her.
She's not at the ministry?
No, I've just rung them. She's disappeared. Bye, Steve.
The plot, as they say, or as Rosemary Z. Glade would say, thickens considerably.
Where am I?
Well, that's hardly an original thing to say when coming round. You're in my apartment.
Your apartment? What am I doing here?
Recovering from a tiny little accident. You tried to kill me.
What? What? Oh, my head.
Now, don't try and move yet. Oh. Just lie there and recover. You had a nasty fall.
You say I tried to kill you? Now, why should I want to do that?
Well, I was hoping that you'd tell me that. Try and remember what happened immediately before you came here.
I can't. I can't. It's all a blank. I remember reading a book.
A book? Reading a book? Ah, yes. One of the novels of Rosemary Z. Glade, perhaps?
No, I never read novels. It was official. A book at the ministry. The sort of book one reads, digests, and passes on.
Book? Ah, yes. The book.
Steed crossed to the table and picked up the volume he'd taken from the printing room at Casanova, Inc.
Got to go now, Mr. Fryer. Stay until you feel better. Bye.
In the offices of Casanova, Inc., Bromfield and Martha stood looking at Mrs. Peel, who was sitting in an easy chair with a dazed expression on her face. She smiled up at Bromfield adoringly.
What are we going to do with her?
You're with Mrs. Peel, Martha. Why, nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing at all. You see, it won't be necessary. She'll do anything for me. And to my dear.
Oh, yes. Yes, anything.
You see, she loves me. Don't you, Mrs. Peel?
Oh, yes.
She loves me to death, in fact. Open the window, Martha.
What?
Do as I say. Open the window.
Oh, very well.
Now, Mrs. Peel, my dear, give me your hand. That's right. Now come along and have a good look at the view. There we are. Beautiful, isn't it? Isn't it beautiful, darling?
Yes. Yes, it's beautiful.
And beautiful things should be enjoyed to the full. So I want you to step out onto the window ledge and take a closer look.
Yes. Yes, all right.
Then I shall ask you to do something else. Come along. That's it.
What must I do?
The reason for asking you to do this is that I can never see you again.
Oh, no.
It's true. So there's no point in continuing to live, is there?
No. No, there's no point.
Now take your time. But you can't come back in here, so off you go, then.
Leaving Mrs. Peel literally teetering on the ledge outside the wide window, Bromfield returned to Martha and the large map of England, which was spread out on the desk.
Now, Martha, are you sure Fryer's information was correct?
There's no reason to doubt its accuracy. He was just as thoroughly hooked as the rest.
Hmm. How did it feel to have the whole of the ministry in love with you?
I can take it or leave it. They were all so boring.
Did it make you feel proud to have so many worshippers?
Not that I knew they couldn't help themselves.
Never underestimate the power of the written word.
Men, Frank Crummett is here with me to say a word about Roy Tan cigars. Frank Crummett.
I'm really a fan for Roy Tan, and the reason is Roy Tan has more long filler Havana tobacco, and yet it's a 5-cent cigar. Man to man, smoke Roy Tan.
Are you sure Fryer's information was correct?
There's no reason to doubt its accuracy. He was just as thoroughly hooked as the rest.
How did it feel to have the whole of the ministry in love with you?
I can take it or leave it. They were all so boring.
Did it make you feel proud to have so many worshippers?
Not that I knew they couldn't help themselves.
Never underestimate the power of the written word. Look at this book. It looks so large at home. Uninteresting and requiring a great deal of concentration. Those poor fools will never know what hit them.
Oh, darling, no one is as clever as you are. You can make anybody do anything.
Only with this to aid me.
Bromfield opened the book, revealing a tiny mechanism in the back cover.
This little gadget, those little microdots, an unbeatable combination. Subliminal indoctrination. They read the words, but this message is between the lines. I must say you've done well, Martha.
Is there anything else you want me to find out?
No. Now here on this map is marked the new security system in full. It's all complete. We fulfilled our promise.
And when do we get the money?
As soon as we deliver this information. Where's Athene?
Athene?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Bromfield. I'm right here.
Let's start getting the stuff out of here right away.
Yes, sir. You leave everything to me. I'll see to it all. Right.
What about her outside the window?
Oh, she's just waiting for the final order to jump. All right, Mrs. Peel. I'm going now. When I say jump, my dear, be a good girl and jump. Right. Jump!
John Steed, heading for Casanova, Inc., had parked his car and was walking down the road when he looked up and saw the strange sight of Emma Peel on the window ledge. He got himself into the building in double-quick time and headed for the offices. Martha and Bromfield left by one door as Steed belted into the room by the other. Tearing across the room, he seized Mrs. Peel by the belt of her costume and jerked her back into the room.
Come back in here. What the devil do you think you're doing? Is this a publicity stunt or something?
I have nothing left to live for. It's the worst thing that's ever happened to me. He has left me.
Oh, Bromfield?
Of course.
You're in love with him?
Desperately.
Infatuated or indoctrinated? You know, the trouble with you, Mrs. Peel, is you read too much.
And the trouble with you, Steed, is you interfere too much.
John Steed dived at Bromfield's legs and the shot went wide. Steed struggled with him on the ground, grabbed him by the hair and crashed his skull against a metal filing cabinet.
How dare you? How dare you lay hands on him?
Hey, I'm on your side, remember?
Let go! Let me go, you brute!
If I do, will you stop this nonsense?
No, I'll scratch your eyes out!
Very well, then, on your own head, be it.
Oh.
Steed grabbed his bowler, which had come off in the struggle, and bopped Mrs. Peel smartly over the head.
I know love is blind, but this is ridiculous.
Steed placed Mrs. Peel in a comfortable chair and set about examining the pile of books in the corner. He found the mechanical device in the cover and, holding it up to a mirror, examined it through a powerful magnifying glass. He managed to read,
"You will fall in love with the next person you see." Well, if one of these little mechanisms works on a person reading a book, I wonder what effect half a dozen of them will do.
Steed.
Steed, my dear boy, congratulations. So, Bromfield and the woman are in custody, and you've cleared the whole matter up as usual. Brilliant, dear fellow. You're brilliant.
Oh, isn't he? Isn't he just too wonderful, Mother?
He is. Extraordinarily talented, charming man.
Oh, thank you, Mother. Thank you, Mrs. Peel.
Oh, Steed, I do love you.
And so you should, Mrs. Peel. How you've managed to cultivate such charm, Steed, such panache.
Well, I thought it such a waste that Bromfield's invention should be thrown away. I had a few of the gadgets made into coat buttons, you see. Two on my suit, four on my waistcoat. A bit flashy, but effective. Take a good look, Mrs. Peel.
Oh, Steed. Steed, you are beautiful.
Much more effective than Midsummer Night's Dream. Shakespeare brought up to date, in fact. Give me your hands if we be friends, and Mother shall restore amends. Open the other bottle of champagne, will you, Mrs. Peel?
The Avengers. Listen every evening, Monday to Friday, to John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers, brought to you by the makers of Cold Water Omo.
For the next 23 minutes or so, we're going to listen to a couple of short stories from the Leiberbach Project. I certainly am grateful for the Leiberbach Project, and you'll find a link for the URL to the Leiberbach Project on the Night Transmissions websites. You might want to check it out. There's a lot of good stuff there. I can't say that the volunteers who read this stuff are always up to the standards set by professional readers, generally actors who are out of work, but most of them are sincere and quite listenable, particularly for the shorter stories, which is why so far I try to keep contributions on this program from the Leiberbach to no more than about 30 minutes. Anyway, the first one up today is a short story that was originally published in Astounding Science Fiction magazine in 1955. Blessed Are the Meek. I only barely remember the name G.C. Edmondson. I'd have to say that he made no great impression on me, although in researching this, I have discovered that many people consider him to be a seriously underrated author. I don't know. I do like this story. If you want to follow up on G.C. Edmondson, there's a link at the website.
The strangers landed just before dawn, incinerating a good li of bottom land in the process. Their machines were already busily digging up the topsoil. The old one watched, squinting into the morning sun. He sighed, hitched up his saffron robes, and started walking down toward the strangers. Griffin turned, not trying to conceal his excitement. You're the linguist. See what you can get out of him. I might, Kung Su ventured sourly, if you'd go weed the air machine or something. This is going to be hard enough without a lot of kibitzers cramping my style and scaring old Pruneface here half to death. I see your point, Griffin answered. He turned and started back toward the diggings. Let me know if you make any progress with the local language. He stopped whistling and strove to control the jauntiness of his gait. Must be the lower gravity. An extra oxygen, he thought. I haven't bounced along like this for 30 years. Nice place to settle down if some promoter doesn't turn it into an old folks' home. He sighed and glanced over the diggings. The rammed earth walls were nearly obliterated by now. Nothing lost, he reflected. It's all on tape, and they're no different from 1,000 others at any rate. Griffin opened a door in the transparent bubble from which Albanez was operating the diggers. Anything? He inquired. Nothing so far, Albanez reported. What's the score on this job? I missed the briefing. How'd you make it out on 3, by the way? Same old stuff, parlory shards and the usual junk. See it once and you've seen it all. Well, Griffin began, it looks like the same thing here again. We've pretty well covered this system, and you know how it is. Rammed earth walls, here and there, pottery shards, flint, bronze, and iron artifacts, and that's it. They got to the Iron Age on every planet, and then blowy. Artifacts all made for humanoid hands, I suppose. I wonder if they were close enough to have crossbred with humans. I couldn't say. I couldn't say, Griffin observed dryly. From the looks of old Pruneface, I doubt if we'll ever find a human female with sufficiently detached attitude to find out. Who's Pruneface? He came ambling down out of the hills this morning and walked into camp. You mean you've actually found a live humanoid? There's got to be a first time for everything. Griffin opened the door and started climbing the hill toward Kung Su and Pruneface. Well, have you gotten beyond the me Charlie stage yet? Griffin inquired at breakfast 2 days later. Kung Su gave an inscrutable East Los Angeles smile. As a matter of fact, I'm a little farther along. Joe is amazingly cooperative. Joe? Spell it Chow, if you want to be exotic. It's still pronounced Joe, and that's his name. The language is monosyllabic and tonal. I happen to know a similar language. You mean this humanoid speaks Chinese? Griffin was never sure whether Kung was ribbing him or not. Not Chinese. The vocabulary is different, but the syntax and phonemes are nearly identical. I'll speak it perfectly in a week. It's just a question of memorizing 2,000 or 3,000 new words. Incidentally, Joe wants to know why you're digging up his bottomland. He was all set to flood it today. Don't tell me he plants rice, Griffin exclaimed. I don't imagine it's rice, but it needs flooding, whatever it is. Ask him how many humanoids there are on this planet. I'm way ahead of you, Griffin. He says there are only a few thousand left. The rest were all destroyed in a war with the barbarians. Barbarians? They're extinct. How many races were there? I'll get to that if you'll stop interrupting, Kung rejoined testily. Joe says there are only two kinds of people, his own dark, straight-haired kind, and the barbarians. They have curly hair, white skin, and round eyes. You'd pass for a barbarian, according to Joe, only you don't have a face full of hair. He wants to know how things are going on the other planets. I suppose that's my cue to break into a cold sweat and feel a premonition of disaster. Griffin tried to smile and almost made it. Not necessarily, but it seems our Iron Age man is fairly well informed in extraplanetary affairs. I guess I'd better start learning the language. Thanks to the spadework Kung Su had done in preparing hypno-recordings, Griffin had a working knowledge of the rational people's language 11 days later when he sat down to drink herb-infused hot water with Joe and other old ones in the low-roofed wooden building around which clustered a village of 200 humanoids. He fidgeted through interminable ritualistic cups of hot water. Eventually, Joe hid his hands in the sleeves of his robe and turned with an air of polite inquiry. Now we get down to business, Griffin thought. Joe, you know by now why we're digging up your bottom land. We'll recompense you in one way or another. Meanwhile, could you give me a little local history? Joe smiled like a well-nourished bodhisattva. Approximately how far back would you like me to begin? At the beginning. How long is a year on your planet? Joe inquired. Your year is 8.5 days longer. Our day is 300 heartbeats longer than yours. Joe nodded in thanks. More water? Griffin declined, suppressing a shudder. 5 million years ago, we were limited to one planet, Joe began. The court astronomer had a vision of our planet in flames. I imagine you'd say our sun was about to nova. The Empress was disturbed and ordered a convocation of seers. One fasted over long and saw an answer. As the dying seer predicted, the Son of Heaven came with fire-breathing dragons. The fairest of maidens and the strongest of our young men were taken to serve his warriors. We served them honestly and faithfully. 1,000 years later, their empire collapsed, leaving us scattered across the universe. 3,000 years later, a new race of barbarians conquered our planets. We surrendered naturally, and soon were serving our new masters. 500 years passed, and they destroyed themselves. This has been the pattern of our existence from that day to this. You mean you've been slaves for 5 million years? Griffin was incredulous. Servitude has ever been a refuge for the scholar and the philosopher. But what point is there in such a life? Why do you continue living this way? What is the point in any way of life? Continued existence, personal immortality, is neither desirable nor possible. We settled for perpetuation of the race. But what about self-determination? You know enough astronomy to understand Nova. Surely you realize it could happen again. What would you do without a technology to build spaceships? Many stars have gone Nova during our history. Usually the barbarians came in time. When they didn't, you mean you don't really care? All barbarians ask that sooner or later, Joe smiled. Sometimes, toward the end, they even accuse us of destroying them. We don't. Every technology bears the seeds of its own destruction. The stars are older than the machinery that explores them. You use technology to get from one system to another. We used it, but we were never part of it. When machines fail, their people die. We have no machines. What would you do if the sun were to nova? We can serve you. We are not unintelligent. Willing to work your way around the galaxy, eh? But what if we refuse to take you? The race would go on. Kung Su tells me there is no life on planets of the system, but there are other systems. You're whistling in the dark, Griffin scoffed. How do you know if any of the rational people survive? How far back does your history go? Joe inquired. It's hard to say exactly, Griffin replied. Our earliest written records date back some 7,000 years. You are all of one race? No, you may have noticed Kung Su is slightly different from the rest of us. Yes, Griffin, I have noticed. When you return, ask Kung Su for the legend of creation. More hot water? Joe stirred, and Griffin guessed the interview was over. He drank another ritual cup, made his farewells, and walked thoughtfully back to camp. Kung, Griffin asked over coffee next afternoon, how well up are you on Chinese mythology? Oh, fair, I guess. It isn't my field, but I remember some of the stories my grandfather used to tell me. What is your legend of creation? Griffin persisted. It's pretty well garbled, but I remember something about the Son of Heaven bringing the early settlers from a land of two moons on the back of his fire-breathing dragon. The dragon got sick and died, so they couldn't ever get back to heaven again. There's a lot of stuff about devils, too. What about devils? I don't remember too well, but they were supposed to do terrible things to you, and even to your unborn children, if they ever caught you. They must have been pretty stupid, though. They couldn't turn corners. My grandfather's store had devil screens at all the doors, so you had to turn a corner to get in. The first time I saw the lead baffles at the pile chamber doors on the ship, it reminded me of home sweet home. By the way, some young men from the village were around today. They want to work passage to the next planet. What do you think? Griffin was silent for a long time. Well, what do you say? We can use some hand labor for the delicate digging. Want to put them on? Might as well, Griffin answered. There's a streetcar every millennium anyway. What do you mean by that? You wouldn't understand. You sold your birthright to the barbarians. End of Blessed Are the Meek by G.C. Edmondson.
This is a LibriVox recording. Recording by Alan Winteroud. Ghosts by Guy de Maupassant. Just at the time when the Concordat was in its most flourishing condition, a young man belonging to a wealthy and highly respected middle-class family went to the office of the head of police at P, and begged for his help and advice, which was immediately promised him. "My father threatens to disinherit me," the young man then began. "Although I have never offended against the laws of the state, of morality, or of his paternal authority, merely because I do not share his blind reverence for the Catholic Church and her ministers. On that account, he looks upon me not merely as latitudinarian, but as a perfect atheist, and a faithful old manservant of ours, who is much attached to me, and who accidentally saw my father's will, told me in confidence that he had left all his property to the Jesuits. I think this is highly suspicious, and I fear that the priests have been maligning me to my father. Until less than a year ago, we used to live very quietly and happily together, but ever since, he has had so much to do with the clergy, our domestic peace and happiness are at an end." "What you have told me," the official replied, "is as likely as it is regrettable, but I fail to see how I can interfere in the matter. Your father is in full possession of all his mental faculties, and can dispose of all his property exactly as he pleases. I also think that your protest is premature. You must wait until his will can legally take effect, and then you can invoke the aid of justice. I am sorry to say that I can do nothing for you." "I think you will be able to," the young man replied, "for I believe that a very clever piece of deceit is being carried on here. How? Please explain yourself more clearly. When I remonstrated with him yesterday evening, he referred to my dead mother, and at last assured me, in a voice of the deepest conviction, that she had frequently appeared to him, and had threatened him with all the torments of the damned if he did not disinherit his son, who had fallen away from God, and leave all his property to the church. Now, I do not believe in ghosts. Neither do I, the police director replied, but I cannot well do anything on this dangerous ground if I had nothing but superstitions to go upon. You know how the church rules all our affairs since the concordat with Rome, and if I investigate this matter and obtain no results, I am risking my post. It would be very different if you could adduce any proofs for your suspicions. I do not deny that I should like to see the clerical party, which will, I fear, be the ruin of Austria, receive a staggering blow. Try, therefore, to get to the bottom of this business, and then we will talk it over again. About a month passed without the young latitudinarian being heard of. But then he suddenly came one evening, evidently in a great state of excitement, and told him that he was in a position to expose the priestly deceit which he had mentioned, if the authorities would assist him. The police director asked for further information. "I have obtained a number of important clues," the young man said. "In the first place, my father confessed to me that my mother did not appear to him in our house, but in the churchyard where she is buried. My mother was consumptive for many years, and a few weeks before her death she went to the village of S., where she died and was buried. In addition to this, I found out from our footman that my father has already left the house twice, late at night, in company of X., the Jesuit priest, and that on both occasions he did not return till morning. Each time he was remarkably uneasy and low-spirited after his return, and had three masses said for my dead mother. He also told me just now that he has to leave home this evening on business, but immediately he told me that our footman saw the Jesuit go out of the house. We may therefore assume that he intends this evening to consult the spirit of my dead mother again, and this will be an excellent opportunity for getting on the track of the matter if you do not object to opposing the most powerful force in the empire for the sake of such an insignificant individual as myself. Every citizen has an equal right to the protection of the state, the police director replied, and I think that I have shown often enough that I am not wanting in courage to perform my duty, no matter how serious the consequences may be. But only very young men act without any prospects of success, as they are carried away by their feelings. When you came to me the first time, I was obliged to refuse your request for assistance. But today your shares have risen in value. It is now 8 o'clock, and I shall expect you in 2 hours' time here in my office. At present, all you have to do is hold your tongue. Everything else is my affair. As soon as it was dark, 4 men got into a closed carriage in the yard of the police office, and were driven in the direction of the village of S. Their carriage, however, did not enter the village, but stopped at the edge of a small wood in the immediate neighborhood. Here they all four alighted. They were the police director, accompanied by the young latitudinarian, a police sergeant, and an ordinary policeman who was, however, dressed in plain clothes. "The first thing for us to do is examine the locality carefully," the police director said. "It is 11 o'clock, and the exercisers of ghosts will not arrive before midnight, so we have time to look round us and to take our measure." The 4 men went to the churchyard, which lay at the end of the village near the little wood. Everything was still as death, and not a soul was to be seen. The sexton was evidently sitting in the public house, for they found the door of his cottage locked, as well as the door of the little chapel that stood in the middle of the churchyard. "Where is your mother's grave?" the police director asked, but as there were only a few stars visible, it was not easy to find it. But at last they managed it, and the police director looked about in the neighborhood of it. "The position is not a very favorable one for us," he said at last. "There is nothing here, not even a shrub behind which we could hide." But just then the policeman said that he had tried to get into the sexton's hut through the door or the window, and that at last he had succeeded in doing so by breaking open a square in the window which had been mended with paper, and that he had opened it and obtained possession of the key which he had brought to the police director. His plans were very quickly settled. He had the chapel opened and went in with the young latitudinarian. Then he told the police sergeant to lock the door behind him and to put the key back where he had found it, and to shut the window of the sexton's cottage carefully. Lastly, he made arrangements as to what they were to do in case anything unforeseen should occur, whereupon the sergeant and the constable left the churchyard, lay down in a ditch at some distance from the gate, but opposite to it. Almost as soon as the clock struck 11:30, they heard steps near the chapel, whereupon the police director and the young latitudinarian went to the window, in order to watch the beginning of the exorcism, and as the chapel was in total darkness, they thought that they should be able to see without being seen. But matters turned out differently from what they expected. Suddenly the key turned in the lock, and they barely had time to conceal themselves behind the altar before two men came in, one of whom was carrying a dark lantern. One was the young man's father, an elderly man of the middle class, who seemed very unhappy and depressed. The other the Jesuit Father K, a tall, thin, big-boned man, with a thin, bilious face, in which two large gray eyes shone restlessly under their bushy black eyebrows. He lit the tapers, which were standing on the altar, and then began to say a requiem mass, while the old man knelt on the altar steps and served him. When it was over, the Jesuit took the book of the Gospels and the holy water sprinkler and went slowly out of the chapel, while the old man followed him with a holy water basin in one hand and a taper in the other. Then the police director left his hiding place, and stooping down so as not to be seen, he crept to the chapel window, where he cowered down carefully, and the young man followed his example. They were now looking straight on his mother's grave. The Jesuit, followed by the superstitious old man, walked three times round the grave. Then he remained standing before it, and by the light of the taper he read a few passages from the Gospel. Then he dipped the holy water sprinkler three times into the holy water basin, and sprinkled the grave three times. Then both returned to the chapel, knelt down outside it with their faces toward the grave, and began to pray aloud, until at last the Jesuit sprang up in a species of wild ecstasy, and cried out three times in a shrill voice, "Exsurge! Exsurge! Exsurge!" Scarcely had the last word of the exorcism died away when thick blue smoke rose out of the grave, which rapidly grew into a cloud and began to assume the outlines of a human body, until at last a tall white figure stood behind the grave and beckoned with its hand. "Who art thou?" the Jesuit asked solemnly, while the old man began to cry. "When I was alive, I was called Anna Maria B," the ghost replied in a hollow voice. "Will you answer all my questions?" the priest continued. "As far as I can." "Have you not yet been delivered from purgatory by our prayers and all the masses for your soul which we have said for you?"
"Not yet, but soon, soon I shall be."
"When?"
"As soon as that blasphemer, my son, has been punished."
"Has that not already happened? Has not your husband disinherited his lost son and made the church his heir in his place?"
"That is not enough."
"What must he do besides?"
"He must deposit his will with the judicial authorities as his last will and testament, and drive the reprobate out of his house."
"Consider well what you are saying. Must this really be?"
"It must, or otherwise I shall have to languish in purgatory much longer,"
the sepulchral voice replied with a deep sigh. But the next moment it yelled out in terror, "Oh, good Lord!" And the ghost began to run away as fast as it could. A shrill whistle was heard, and then another, and the police director laid his hand on the shoulder of the exorciser, accompanied with the remark, "You are in custody." Meanwhile, the police sergeant and the policeman, who had come into the churchyard, had caught the ghost and dragged it forward. It was the sexton who had put on a flowing white dress and who wore a wax mask, which bore a striking resemblance to his mother, as the son declared. When the case was heard, it was proved that the mask had been very skillfully made from a portrait of the deceased woman. The government gave orders that the matter should be investigated as secretly as possible, and left the punishment of Father K to the spiritual authorities, which was a matter of course, at a time when priests were outside the jurisdiction of the civil authorities. And it is needless to say that he was very comfortable during his imprisonment in a monastery in a part of the country which abounded with game and trout. The only valuable result of the amusing ghost story was that it brought about a reconciliation between father and son, and the former, as a matter of fact, felt such deep respect for priests and their ghosts in consequence of the apparition that a short time after his wife had left purgatory for the last time in order to talk with him, he turned Protestant. Recording by Alan Winteroud, boomcoach.blogspot.com.
Oh, I'm sorry to do this to you, but we'll get right back to our programming in a moment. Henri René Albert Guy de Maupassant, as it happens, was born on the 5th of August of 1850 and would die on July the 6th of 1894 at the age of 42. He was a popular 19th century writer who was considered one of the fathers of the modern ghost story. His stories are characterized by a certain economy of style and an efficient, effortless spinning of the tale. Here, too, if you want to look a little further into Guy de Maupassant, there are links at the website that will take you to a little more information, a little more depth into him. Oh, and also, for both this story and the Edmondson story, there are links that will take you to the Gutenberg site, where you can download the actual text of these stories. For segment 4, we have The Price of Fear, Out of the Mouths. The Price of Fear is a horror mystery program produced somewhat sporadically by the BBC radio. It was really quite successful, although you might not know it from the number of shows produced, 22. But they were produced over a period of 10 years, from 1972 to 1982, so that is some testament to their success. They did keep making them, just not too many of them. And it is excellent. Drawing from some of the great writers in the genres, people like William Ingram, Roald Dahl, and A.M. Burrage, Bram Stoker even. The show is hosted by and usually starred Vincent Price, which is why I guess they called it The Price of Fear. This show is a little bit of a departure in that it does not star Vincent Price. He just does the narration and gets inconspicuously out of the way. I think the best stories all have Vincent in them. So I guess I'd have to admit this isn't one of the best stories, but even a less than stellar production from The Price of Fear is better than the best effort of so many other radio programs. I hope after you listen to this, you'll think so too.
Hello and welcome. Richard Atkins was a research buffoon. If you were to ask him what kind, he might tell you, I specialize in electrospectroanalysis of human enzyme and molecular structures. And when you'd look suitably blank, he'd smile and add, what makes us tick? To understand Richard Atkins, the trick was not to let his modest manner fool you. At 40, he was probably the best in his field, one of a very select research team. The world seemed his oyster. But then, the same world lost sight of him. Many years later, those caring enough to remember settled for, came a bit of a cropper, all a bit hush-hush under the carpet. Few knew the cropper was entirely of his own making.
David, what the hell are you still doing here?
Well, just thought I'd hang on a bit, see how it went.
My confrontation with the head, much as expected, all very low-keyed, civilized. So, a shoulder to cry on?
If you wanted one.
Touching, but don't you think I'm a bit old for all that?
I was thinking more along the lines of drink.
Improvement. This shouldn't take me long.
Richard, what the hell are you doing?
Clearing out my desk.
But why?
Can't it wait till tomorrow?
It'll save me the extra trip in. Besides, I don't think I could stand all those raised eyebrows, querying glances, told you so's from the less charitably inclined.
It would only be...
With my best interests at heart?
If you like.
I don't think I could take that either. Right? Right.
Truce?
Truce. Final tally. One box of paper clips. Three pencils, black, for the use of. Oh, two broken, so not for the use of. Assorted elastic bands come in handy. I can make tanks out of cotton reels and matches.
That brings back memories.
Doesn't it, just the... Just the caper for whiling away my premature retirement.
Richard.
Not pulling your weight, old fellow. Reason's best known to yourself, old fellow. But the whole project falling behind, old fellow. Rest of the team down, old fellow. Dee-da-dee-da-dee-da. That was in triplicate, wasn't it?
Just about. Was that all he said?
Just about. Really rather touching, though.
What?
Whatever it was, he thought he was doing, poor old sod. So stewed in scientific jargon, anything approaching the human touch is quite beyond him. Ever the scientist. Options open right to the end.
Oh?
Showed me the door, but still didn't have the guts to slam it hard behind me.
Oh?
Losing a good man.
That's a fact.
Big step, couple of weeks leave, time to think it over. That came in triplicate, too.
Why don't you?
Right. I think I've earned that drink now.
By the way, how's Rachel?
She's fine, just fine.
It's been ages. Kate and I were wondering if you
both... Oh, for Christ's sake. I think we can skip the social niceties, don't you? There's no need, David, old mate.
For what?
For whatever the hell it is you think you're doing.
Richard, we're not just colleagues, we're friends.
No hard feelings, but I don't think friendship comes into this. Not in the long run.
A sounding board, then. Some kind of explanation. You owe it to me.
Do I just? Yes. Yes, I do, don't I? Let's face it, friend David. I was roped in on the project because they thought I could contribute something.
They obviously still do.
I could almost write them my end-of-term report. Reliable, diligent, oh, very occasionally restive, but perfectly manageable.
Well?
I just reached the point where I got sick of being diligent at the expense of being only occasionally restive.
I see.
You don't. And I'm not much better equipped to explain it. Just that recently, I've been staring down the wrong end of the microscope. So busy manipulating or trying to so many pieces of the jigsaw, I've lost sight of the overall pattern of things. That's all.
Go on.
This great secret we're all after. Evolution. The fountainhead. Call it what you like. Because the word hasn't been coined that could do it justice. But we've always considered it a process of growth. Growth. Growth physical, growth intellectual, growth spiritual. And I'm still scientist enough to put spiritual last.
Well?
I simply don't think of it as growth any longer. Deterioration. That's what we should be setting our sights on.
But isn't that part of the same?
No, I'm not just talking about the inevitable cellular deterioration, gaga, second childhood. I'm talking about something altogether more subtle. The kind of deterioration induced by the education of a child. What I'm trying to say is at the very outset, in the very early stages, in a child's pre-formative years, you see, I suspect it's all there.
All?
Inherent awareness, absolute knowledge, already there, encapsulated.
From birth?
It obsesses me. If we could only catch the child early enough, before the educating process has begun. If we could somehow tap in, contrive to communicate with the newly born on its terms, not ours. God only knows, David, what it is we might tap into.
And a little child shall lead them.
If you like.
Prophetic, but hardly scientific.
If you like. Daunting, though, isn't it?
You wouldn't even know where to begin.
Let alone where it might end. I told you it was too early for words.
Rachel was still up when Richard got home. He could have wished it otherwise. Concerned attention was the last thing he wanted. But behind her ministering was a feeling of something deeper, unspoken. as though she, too, had news she was finding it difficult to put into words.
More coffee?
Oh, no, thanks. It's coming out of my ears.
How are you feeling?
Death. I'd hoped you'd be tucked in before I got back.
David rang.
Due warning. Typical.
You meant it for the best.
Typical. You're being very mute about it all.
I thought that's what you wanted.
It speaks volumes.
It's not that I'm against any decision you decide to make.
Wrong tense. But?
I just think...
that David might be right.
He is your friend.
Yes. He tried that tack, too.
Well, why didn't you give yourself more time? Talk about it.
What the hell is there to talk about? An instinct? You don't talk about instincts, Rachel. I just know that all these years I've been facing the wrong way. That's all. It doesn't follow I know where I'm going from here.
And you'd risk everything you've achieved? Your reputation, your position, your home for that?
Oh, God forbid I should ever risk my home.
You know what I mean.
If it's the roof over your head you're worrying about, he went with the job. But a year's get out either side, all right?
Richard!
They'll stick to their side of the bargain. You can count on it. If only to see if I'll back down, come to heel. So, not much risk of your having to pitch a tent, doss under the arches just yet. Oh. All right.
You think I'd mind if I had to?
No. No, I don't. Just one of the reasons I married you.
If I sounded over-anxious, petty...
No, no.
Concerned, then?
What the hell about?
Not for my own sake.
Surely not for mine.
Not for yours either, particularly.
Well, then?
We're going to have a child.
Rachel? Rachel?
Your face! A little child shall lead them, as the prophet said.
That's the second time I've heard that today.
Their child was a boy. Their decision to name it David was mutual, and by the time the christening party came around, any feeling of antagonism there might have been between Richard and his one-time colleague seemed as remote as if it had never happened.
I'm so glad you could come, David.
It's my own godson's christening party. A bit rum will do without me. Besides, you named him after me. You're like missing your own launching. And all that stuff about setting him a Christian example. A bit below the belt, wasn't it? Lord only knows how I'm going to live up to it.
I did think...
What?
You might prefer to opt out.
Why on earth should I?
Past behaviour patterns?
I'd take more than that. It was only a temporary lapse on your part.
Was it?
Water under the bridge.
Is it?
Which is more than can be said for these champagne bubbles.
Richard?
I hear.
The storm must have woken him.
Well, he woke the storm. It's all right, love. Back to sleep. I'll see to young Caruso. What's up, Brighton? Burning the midnight oil, are we? Where are you now? In that wonderful, uncorrupted brain of yours. Where are you now, young David? Coming to grips with Pythagoras? Arguing polemics with Plato? Beyond our mediocre comprehension, I'll wager. Or was it just that nasty, wasty, stormy, warmy disturbing you then? But you must know the scientific explanation to that one. A turbulence caused by areas of high pressure moving in to fill corresponding areas of low. That's a theory, you know. Or maybe you know better, eh?
We're both fine.
You're disturbing Mumsy Wumsy. If you can't sleep, we'd better settle for a 10-minute tour of the estate.
Rachel's call to David was brief, But behind her request that he come around as soon as possible, he sensed an underlying feeling of panic and urgency. Richard was out. Together they sat in the small kitchen, David listening intently. But Rachel was distant, far off, reliving that night of the storm. The almost hypnotic trance instilled in her husband by the wide, innocent eyes of the child.
I must have dropped off to sleep again, David. I've no idea for how long. It might have been minutes, hours. I only know I woke up with a start. Richard's side of the bed was empty. No sound from the nursery, but a feeling of...
Yes?
Coldness, a chill. Something I'd never known before. I called his name down the stairs, but he didn't answer. When I eventually found him, he was in the study, standing at the blackboard.
It was ordinary enough.
Yes, but there was something about it that was almost awesome. It's a funny word to use. But as though I was in the presence of...
Of what, Rachel?
He was holding young David in the crook of one arm. I couldn't see, but I knew instinctively the baby's eyes were open, wide open, staring into Richard's with a kind of fierce intensity one doesn't associate with a child.
And Richard?
Oh, totally unaware of me. He was writing on the blackboard. God knows I've watched him do that at all hours. Have to get it out of my head. The only way I can get back to sleep. But this time, one blackboard was filled already. He was halfway down the other.
With what?
Equation after equation. But when I looked closer, all the characters were unrecognizable. Lacking his usual neatness. Unmethodical, sprawling, line after line. Written with a terrifying urgency. In the handwriting of a child, David. The writing of a child. It was the baby who felt me there. A whimper of recognition, part sigh, but part warning. And the writing stopped.
And Richard?
We went back to bed. I nestled in his arms. He didn't even refer to it.
Didn't you?
I never felt the need. Till now. That's why I asked you over.
Oh?
It hasn't stopped, you see. Night after night. Not always with the baby in his arms. Sometimes in the cot at his side. But always... this telepathy between them. I just couldn't keep it to myself any longer. I needed you to see for yourself.
Then how about now?
Yes. All right, then. Through here.
Close the door.
Right.
No chance of us coming back.
Oh, not before lunch. He's taken young David down to the park.
Let's get on with it, then.
Well, what do you make of it? What's on the blackboard?
And what can one say? A child scrawl, but some kind of formula.
Related to his work when he was at the centre?
No, not even remotely. Scientific. A mathematical progression of some kind, and yet... beginning on this board in complexity... diminishing, simplifying, to end in just two indivisible symbols. Alpha, Omega. Beginning, end.
The life force.
Why did you say that?
I don't know.
Is there any chance of you making me a copy of this?
Well, yes, I suppose so.
As soon as you can, Rachel. As soon as you possibly can.
She wondered whether to tell Richard of David's visit. Wondered, too, whether he sensed some deeper significance behind the casual manner with which she finally mentioned it. But if he did, he showed no outward sign of it.
We had a visitor.
Oh?
David.
Well, you hear that, young David? Godfather comes a-calling, and only Mumsy Wumsy here to receive him. What did he want?
Nothing special. Just dropped by to see he's got some.
We see.
Where did you get to?
But we told her the park, didn't we? Had great fun, didn't we? God knows when I found myself sitting on a swing last.
Richard, you didn't.
Did? Thinking of writing to the council. Adult Discrimination Act. 20-year-old age limit at the very least.
You still wouldn't qualify, darling.
What?
Oh, sorry, I've forgotten your fork.
I'll manage with a spoon.
Don't be silly.
I'd rather manage with the spoon. Whoops. Now look what he's done. Naughty, naughty, Daddy. All over his best bib and tucker.
You were warned.
Bib and tucker, bib and tucker, bib and tucker, bib.
Richard, please.
What?
It would be only too easy to gloss over the weeks that followed. For Rachel, the overpowering imperative desire was to convince herself that everything was normal, that nothing untoward was happening, and that even if it wasn't, the real trouble lay in her own imaginings, that nothing in their lives had really changed, that Richard's affinity, this strange extra affinity he had with his son, unspoken, undeniable, was simply part of the process, part of becoming a father. She clung to the notion like a life raft.
I only have to give him time. No, give myself time. If there's anything that needs questioning, it's my attitude. My ridiculous, jealous reaction to it all. As though my own son were some kind of a stranger. An intruder.
The very notion of it appalled her. And so she had to find her consolation in the belief that her husband's behavior was simply a phase again. Of one thing she felt sure, no outside help was needed, especially from the likes of David, the meddling do-gooders. In fact, to be avoided at all cost. A period of togetherness, seclusion, away from the world, was what they needed. But it was Richard, this new Richard, that resisted it, resisted with all his being. There was about him now an almost animal-like capacity for living she'd never known before, as though a contest between them. Mental, but at the same time primevally physical. A morning dawned when she was forced to admit she was losing, that she no longer had any choice, and as before, it was to David she turned.
Rachel, are you all right?
Come in, then.
Thanks. I got your message, but when I rang back, I didn't recognize the voice, so I hung up.
Yes. Richard said he thought it was probably you.
Richard said?
It didn't sound like him.
Well, he's either got one hell of a cold or his voice is on the change.
Come on through.
What's all that racket?
Oh, just kids. Coffee?
No, thanks. Rachel, you've been avoiding me.
Yes. That stuff on the blackboard, you've run into a brick wall, haven't you?
We fed it through the computer.
And?
A blank, beyond computer analysis.
I thought as much. Funny, it doesn't even seem important now. He knew I gave it to you.
You told him?
Just knew. It didn't seem to upset him. Only part of the key was what he said. All in the eyes. He was smiling at the baby at the time. And the baby seemed to know what he was saying and smiled back. And now... Look.
What is it, Rachel?
Come here to the window. Well, tell me what you see.
Richard?
Hardly believable, is it? A change in him. Childlike. That's it, childlike.
What the hell's he up to?
Oh, the boy next door kicked his ball into the garden. In the old days, Richard would have tossed it back with a ticking off for his trouble.
Yes, Father!
Look at him now.
With a fatherly instinct coming out of him.
You know that, isn't it?
Competitive. Like equals.
Would you believe he went out and bought a train set for young David?
A bit premature.
Oh, wasn't it, though? He's laid it out in the attic.
Most nights now I wake to find his bed empty.
I see.
And that ridiculous tiny train rattling overhead. He always despised comic strips. A pet hobby horse. Retards a child's ability to read. Now it's the first thing he turns to when he grabs the morning paper. Idiotic, isn't it? His eating habits have changed from savory to sweet. Would you believe lemonade and peanut butter sandwiches? His dress is more slovenly, his movements more awkward, more boisterous, as though... Well, look at him, David, look at him.
Yes.
You see it, too.
Turning back the clock. I think somehow he's achieving it. The eyes, it's all in the eyes. That's what he said, as though the two of them have developed some kind of extraordinary telepathy between them. Young David, Richard, the child, and the man, enabling him to project himself backwards instead of forwards. Ultimate knowledge through absolute innocence. Backwards, ever backwards, until...
Until what?
Dear God, who knows?
Beginning, yes, no!
They had no ready-made label to stick on Richard's sickness, so they coined one, U-minted, pathological regression. They went through the processes, of course, psychoanalysis, mental therapy, deep hypnosis. But Richard's tragic condition deteriorated. They tried to save face by calling it prescribed, inevitable. They could also have added doomed. One bright summer's morning, if you'd been up early enough, you'd have spotted the ambulance arriving outside the house. You'd also have seen a schoolboy, dressed in a neat gray worsted suit, face beaming, hair slicked, as though for an outing. The nursing home attendant opened the ambulance's back door, but young Master Richard elected to sit up in the front. The accompanying doctor saw no reason to object. As they began to pull away, the boy gave a quick backward glance through an upstairs nursery window. Beyond it, the baby, young David, stirred in his crib and gave a smile of pure innocence.
It, whatever it is that has been happening to me, has stopped. I myself have no doubt of the fact. I do not need their sums and figures of my height and weight, or their little knowing nods and clicks of encouragement, as though it were all their doing. My journey of discovery has come to its end. A good breeze today. Later, they will let me take my sailing boat to the little pond in the grounds. I shall watch it fighting the elements and the rough seas. A week or so ago, they brought a young boy, David, here to see me. He might have been 5 or 6, but I can get nothing from him again. Life's manipulators have had their effect. His wearisome progress forward, thanks to them, has begun. As a result, my return backwards towards... But I shall never know now. It's my birthday tomorrow. They have not yet decided whether I shall be 11 or 12. It doesn't really matter. I know I have stopped in time. No backwards now. No forwards either. The lessons they will give me will certainly get them nowhere. I am far, far beyond their lessons.
Many years later, the young David was to ask his mother, "What happened to my father?" Rachel had prepared herself for that moment. He went away, a long, long way away. It was not too far from the truth.
Well, okay, that's it. We've come to the end of another 2 hours. And so I'm just going to take a moment to say goodbye and tell you that I'll be here next week, and I hope you will, too. In the meantime, this is Gary Clinton, and oh yeah, you can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com.